From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, one of your hosts for a special series presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, we already know that political polarization in the U.S. has reached new heights with the Trump presidency. But how is it reflected in our closest, most intimate relationships? With our families, our colleagues, our significant others? Many Americans prepare to spend another Thanksgiving feuding over the president and the never-ending saga of the 2016 election. Can we do anything about that? That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Again, this is Jamil Smith. This is 1 year later, and you're about to hear a family arguing.
אמא, זה לא הזמן ולא המקום להיות
שמאלנית
יפת נפש.
טוב, שמעתי.
יעל, I don't speak Hebrew, but that sounds intense.
Yeah, Jamil, I wanted to give you a glimpse into how in Israel we fight over politics and specifically over the occupation.
Well, everybody else, I'm Jamil Smith, back with 1 year later. In the studio with me is one of our producers, Yael Evan Orr. Just describe to me what was being said there.
So this is actually from a docu-reality we had in Israel last year, sort of like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, only less glamorous. And this is a mother and a daughter, and they're in the car, and they basically started fighting over Benjamin Netanyahu, our prime minister. But it's getting really intense. At some point, she's telling her daughter, like, you're dumb. And, you know, when they do the talking heads thing, she's just talking to the camera, and she said, I can't believe my daughter is so dumb. And they start yelling at each other on the way to, like, dinner or something.
So they're talking about the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Who is on which side?
So the daughter sort of likes the prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's, you know, is part of the right-wing party. And the mom is a leftist. And so the daughter is like, this is the problem with the left. I can't believe you. This is not the time. There are terrorists. So it's getting really intense. But the thing is, this is not unusual. If you open reality TV in Israel or any other cultural representations, basically, you'll see these kind of fights. You know, in Israel, we have, to put it mildly, an unresolved issue, which is the conflict with the Palestinians. And it's been that way since the country was founded. So it's always there. And it's something that families fight over and friends fight over. And, you know, relationships end because of that.
Wow. So what about your own family?
I had my fair share of arguing with my family over politics. And there were a few more memorable episodes, I would say.
Okay. Can you tell me about any of them?
Yeah. So one of them was about 9 years ago. And it was a family dinner. It's kind of always family dinner. And we were starting, you know, I was going to university. I was learning all these new things. And I started to change my opinions. And I got into this intense fight with my family, and I was on one side, and they were all on the other side. And it got so intense that I couldn't stay there. You know, I was starting to get very emotional and cry, and so I had to leave. And then for a few weeks, like, none of us wanted to, our egos got in the way, and we didn't speak, me and my parents didn't speak for a few long weeks.
Wow.
You know, Israel is a small country, and it's a very familial society, so I usually see my parents like a few times a week, and then for a few weeks not talking to them is a lot. So it took, you know, it was a huge toll on all of us.
So how did you get back to talking eventually?
So what happened eventually was that I was working that one day. It was Friday night, actually, and I got a phone call from my brother, and he was like, well, I know you're not talking to mom and dad now, so that's why we didn't talk to you today. It's Friday night. You usually go to Shabbat dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But just so you know, Dad had a heart episode this morning.
Oh, my goodness.
And he collapsed, and he's in the hospital. And so my dad is okay.
Okay.
He was okay.
Okay, good. Just, I was bracing for a different ending.
I just, when I got out of work, I could go home. And when I got there, we just kind of nodded to each other, sort of agreeing without really talking about it, that we're done talking about politics.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, I felt guilty, even though I'm sure my dad's heart issues had nothing to do with that. But you can't, you know, you can't avoid thinking.
You were thinking maybe that the stress from all this is,
yeah,
it had some bearing on his health.
Yeah, because we were all very stressed. And, you know, and so, yeah, I would say that for at least like a year or two, we kept that promise.
A year or two, then not
until
so much.
until the next thing, you know, the next operation. But I think it's not a very unusual story.
I mean, what lessons do you feel like Americans can draw from what you've been through? Because there's obviously a lot of people who, you know, had family strife because of the 2016 election, the results, people on one side or the other.
Yeah, so I don't know that I have smart lessons to share, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I think it's mostly, so I moved to the U.S. 5 years ago, and I think when I had conversations with people about that, I didn't feel that I could really explain to them what it's like to have this intense fights in your families, and it's not something that I necessarily saw around me. I mean, I think politics was something that you don't always bring up. Even people would talk to me about Israel, and I would get super intense, but that's how I talk about politics, and that's who we are, and since I think since last year, and especially now when we're covering this topic for the show, I feel less lonely, you know, in my experience in political events through this very personal, intimate conversations and feelings.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it better if we just kind of stop talking about politics like you and your dad did? Like, is it better maybe if we all kind of took a break from it, especially within our family structures? Could that help, you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think when the situation called for it, that's what we did for a little bit. It didn't last very long. I think we know our boundaries better now as to when a fight gets too much. But I do genuinely think that our politics is who we are. And I'm not surprised that people feel now that the stakes are so high that they can't just let go, especially when it comes to your loved ones and the people you're close with the most.
Indeed. Yael Evan-Orr, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jamil.
Many Americans indeed can't let go. Jean Fitzpatrick is a marriage counselor and therapist based in New York City. Jean, thanks for joining us. Welcome to 1 Year Later.
Good to be here, Jamil.
Now, you counsel couples at your Manhattan office, and I was living in Brooklyn a year ago when the election happened, and I remember riding the F train the morning afterwards, and I'm sure you do too, the faces just absolutely still and quiet, quieter than any train that I could ever remember in all my years living in New York.
The silent subway ride.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of us surely talk to our therapists about the election, but I can imagine a lot of those folks also had family strife to deal with that was related to Trump's victory. How much did you and your clients talk about that?
Well, the 2 weeks after the election were, without any question, the most stressful time in my practice since 9/11.
Wow.
People came in and they were upset about the election itself. They were also asking the question, what does this mean about us as a country?
Mm. So it was lack of understanding necessarily, or just a lack of acceptance, do you feel like?
It was pretty much shock and real sadness.
Mm. Last week, we put out a call on our social media platforms, Jean, to ask listeners how the election impacted their relationships. Let's listen to one of them.
My name is Sylvia Moreno. I am from California, born and raised, Southern California. My parents are, my father is Mexican, born in Mexico. My mother is Caucasian. Prior to the whole Trump running for office, I already had a somewhat of a strained relationship with my dad, but he wasn't very involved in politics prior to this. During the campaign, I would go visit with them on occasion. I would try to be respectful of the things that they believed in, but I would just try to kind of stay out of it. But during the campaign, my dad became very, very supportive of Donald Trump, just started repeating some of the things that he was talking about during his rallies. My dad would go to rallies. He would on the front lawn of my parents' home, he would have Donald Trump signs saying things that were really contentious, just being really argumentative with me, even though I tried to never get involved in that sort of talk with him because it was just too much for me. So rather than dealing with that, I just asked, a good while before the actual election, I just decided I wasn't going to continue going to my dad's house so that I wouldn't get into arguments with him about it. And we haven't spoken since before then. I don't think that there's going to be a resolution anytime soon.
Jean, do you hear similar stories about extended family maybe? And what are some of the things people can do when the situation is that dire?
So often there are those differences within extended families. And one thing that's really important to keep in mind is those extended family connections are super important to hold on to because often that's our one link to people on the other side. So learning how to make that connection can be really valuable. One thing that's helpful is to make the shift that we talk about in couples therapy from content to process. So in other words, instead of repeating the same statements that you've heard on television or read that your candidate is saying, get a little more personal. Say to your family member, tell me about your neighborhood. Tell me what's going on in your town. Try to bring it down to a human level.
Mm-hmm. Does silence ever work, though? I mean, it seems like, you know, obviously, our caller is saying that, you know, there's no real hope in sight as far as, you know, having a resolution to this. Does silence help as far as, you know, personally, I mean, for self-care at least?
Well, we all need to know how to set up some boundaries that will make the situation tolerable for us. Often what couples will do or extended families will say, let's just not talk about that subject.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, some people feel that it's really important. And I've actually recommended to people, hey, listen, why don't you structure when you're going to talk about it? Like at Thanksgiving, only talk about it over the pumpkin pie and no other time during the meal. And people prefer that to silence because they're saying these issues are really important to us. As a nation, we have to talk about them. I grew up in a big Italian-American family, and one of the best memories I have of childhood is everybody sitting around the table at holiday time debating. I think probably everyone was talking at once. But those were times that I developed a sense of identity in my family, that we were people who cared about the wider world.
Jean Fitzpatrick is a marriage counselor and therapist based in New York City. Again, you're listening to One Year Later. Jean, I want you to listen to another caller of ours. She lives in Arizona, and her husband is a Trump supporter and works for the Border Patrol.
All right. My name is Anna. I'm from Tucson, Arizona. And I met my husband about 7 years ago. When I met him, he told me he was conservative. It was during the Obama administration. And he was still a really nice guy, though I have much different political leanings than he does. After the election of Donald Trump, I think we avoid talking politics a lot more than we did previously. I'm not as willing to engage with him to talk about politics. We just pretty much avoid the subject altogether. And I always wonder if I met him today during the current political climate, if I would consider dating him. That's something I've thought about. And I think that I probably would, just given my experiences with past partners who I had the same political beliefs with, who just weren't decent people. I've definitely been told that how could I be married to somebody who voted for Donald Trump, and that's totally unacceptable, and how could I be with them? I mean, I guess there's a lot of intolerance going around on every side of the political spectrum. So I kind of just laugh it off. I mean, it's the same. He gets the same trouble from his friends about me. and that I get about him, and they don't know how he could be married to someone like me. We both kind of just laugh it off. We both know that it's fine, and we're totally okay with it.
I know a lot of friends, Jean, who are ruling out potential suitors from the jump because they may have supported Donald Trump. And so, you know, on the first date, this is a topic now. Is it good to bring politics not just into our relationships in that way, or is there a way that we can avoid that? And is there a way to, you know, deal with it, you know, in a therapy setting that is more constructive?
Well, I think there's a difference between somebody who's on their first date and somebody who's in a long-term relationship. Long-term relationships are really complicated, and it's the most important thing for either of those people is to think about not reducing the other person to the most objectionable point of view of your opponent, but instead try to understand their own personal connection and what led them to this view. What personal experiences have they had that led them down this path?
And lastly, Jean, real quick, I wanted to ask you, do therapists have any strategy? Do you have any strategy for dealing with the political environment? It's got to be a lot hearing about all these different stories. How do you deal with it personally?
Well, one thing that I do is participate in groups of therapists who care about the wider world, so that I'm a member of the American Association of Pastoral Counselors and of Citizen Therapists for Democracy. And we really understand that humans' well-being is not just about an individual feeling peaceful. It's about being fully alive and connected to community. And just as we recommend to the people we see, we take walks, we use mindfulness techniques.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Jean Fitzpatrick is a couples therapist in New York City. We're going to take a brief break. This is 1 year later from PRI. I'm Jamil Smith, and we're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Before the break, we talked about the Trump presidency's impact on relationships. We've been asking you if the election has caused any rifts in your family. Let's hear from another listener, this time from Colorado.
My name is John Gulick. I live in Eagle, Colorado. I work in public safety as my primary job, and then I'm an inspector for two other places as my secondary jobs. So I have three jobs, and I'm 64 and a half years old, and I don't know how I can keep up at this pace, but I feel pretty good because I enjoy where I live in the Rocky Mountains. So I'm a President Trump supporter because I wanted to see this country change, and one of the key things that made me vote Republican was he stated during the campaign that many older Americans are working two and three and four jobs and making half as much. And I'm right in that boat. It's just kind of funny. My wife and my oldest daughter voted Democratic side, and myself and my younger daughter voted for the Republican side. You know, it kind of hurt us in a way, but with all things considered, you know, we still all live together and share the same place. They were all upset because Hillary was not the first female president. They supported President Obama and voted Democratic. I voted the other way. I was hoping for McCain and Palin the second go around. But we weren't divided back then. I mean, I just kind of let things go when President Obama won his second term. I just kept working, saying, well, you know, maybe things will get better. But when Donald Trump came around, I was like, well, this guy needs a shot. He needs a fair shot because he is smart. And it divided us, but we do laugh a lot about things because some of the way the media portrays Mr. President, he doesn't have much of a fair chance. And, you know, they hold him to his feet to the fire on what he says.
If you want to also share your perspective with us, go to our webpage at kcrw.com/1year later. We want to hear from you. When we put out a call on social media platforms and asked you, how did the Trump presidency impact your family relationships? We got plenty of stories. Some of you shared with us experiences that really touched us, and one of them was the story of J.C. Sterrett from Los Angeles. He and his baby daughter came to our studio last week. J.C., thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And bringing Gemma.
Yeah, right.
Your new addition.
Yes, 2 months. 2 months she's here hanging out, supporting the cause.
All right, she may chime in later. But first, let's get into why you and your sister are not talking.
So we're Hispanic Latinos, 100%. Mm-hmm. I'm first generation. She is, you know, immigrated to this country.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, illegally. She's not a U.S. citizen, but mm-hmm. she is hardcore Republican.
Mm.
Lives in Orange County, and she's gone off the deep end.
So tell me a little bit about how that started. Did you know that she was a Trump supporter before? And how did your interactions start after the election? Like how did those interactions change?
So it's the feuding started during the primaries. Yeah, she demonstrated that she was a Trump supporter. And I really have not been a supporter of him, you know, a decade ago, 20 years ago.
Right.
And she was like, that's my candidate, this and that. And we're finally going to have a good person in the office. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, how, as a female Latina, for, you know, you came to this country as an immigrant.
Right.
Are you going to vote for this guy with that type of rhetoric?
Uh-oh.
Oh, that's
hey,
the baby.
There's the baby. Are there any family members taking her side on this?
So this is the funny part, or I don't know if it's funny. So like I mentioned earlier, we're 100% Latinos, and my mom, my two sisters, my brothers are Trump supporters.
Mm.
And my wife's family, they're all Trump supporters. But it's like, yeah, I can't talk to that
side. You're kind of surrounded.
Yeah, I can't talk to that side of family about, like, what happened. My sister is going to take her side. My other sister and my niece, who were not supporters, they were just like, we're not surprised. It's been problematic with this topic a lot.
I would imagine since he announced that he was running a few years ago, through the election, it must have been really tense.
After the election, because of the heated conversations already happening with my sister. And at one point, I wanted to just cut her off because I just couldn't. I couldn't deal.
Yeah, it's really stressful.
So I would talk to my therapist. I'm like, you know, I'm having a problem about this. And how do I deal with it? And, you know, that side, you know, the right is talking about all this Mac and da da da. And it led into a political heated conversation with the therapist.
Wait, what?
Yeah. He started like, well, the left is all and like bad words. And like, it was not, I was just like, I was in shock because he was like, yeah, you people can believe this. And there's all this fake information being spread out. And
this is your therapist who's supposed to calm your mental state.
Yeah. I actually got a little thrill out of it because it got very heated. And like we had to end the session because it was like, it was a little bit uncomfortable. But he called me back a day later to apologize and said he crossed the line. He crossed a boundary that he shouldn't have.
Mm. So who cut off contact and why?
this is ridiculous how it happened, actually. It happened over Facebook, of all places.
Mm.
I sometimes post a lot of, you know, political information on my feed.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm posting a lot of the Mueller time. And what I posted, actually, when the indictments came out, I posted, someone's getting arrested on Monday. It's not Hillary. Who's it going to be? And she started going off on my feed and posting, she's corrupt. She's going to jail. Arrest her. And other friends of mine who are also pro-Hillary, they start to chime in, and then she starts feuding with my friends on my Facebook feed.
Oh, boy.
And then she started posting all these nasty memes. When she started posting on my feed, all I did was just delete it.
Mm.
And she started texting me and was like, why are you deleting my messages? I can't believe you're doing that. Whose side are you on? This is family. This is how you treat family. Well, the text continued. She's like, you might as well just block me, unfollow me. Like a minute later, she's like, never mind. I already blocked you. I already unfollowed you. Don't ever call me again. Don't ever text me again.
Don't ever call me again.
Don't ever call me again. Don't ever text me. And like, have fun with your life. I mean, I have it here, actually.
Wow. How did you respond to that?
So what's even crazier is like, she's like my mother.
Okay.
And she's the one who raised me. I'm the godfather to her son. Mm. Her daughter is like my best friend.
And you have a new daughter here that presumably she would want to see.
Well,
or be a part of her life.
Be a part of, which is really what, really hurts my feelings. I just responded, was like, well, it's on you, dear. Person that gets mad loses. I actually put it in Spanish. Que se enoja, pierde. I was like, that's a shame. I can't believe you chosen Trump over me.
What do you want to say to your sister, if anything, at this point?
I mean, I love you. That's it. I love you. I understand. I understand why you're angry and upset about the situation. And no, I didn't choose, friends over family. Never. I would never do that.
A political candidate over family.
Especially not over a political candidate. Because it all doesn't really even matter. Does it matter? Does it really matter?
Maybe not as much as this.
No, not the future here. Yeah, it's pretty intense.
What do you think, Gemma? Yeah. JC, thank you for coming in, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Like JC's story, many of the family feuds you told us about involve some form of social media. Often, they seem to make the situation worse. Aaron Smith is with us. He's the Associate Director for Internet and Technology Issues at the Pew Research Center. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, I have been known, in my past at least, to get into an argument or two on Twitter, all of which seem just fruitless at the end when you're just done. It just seems like a complete waste of your time. But I can't imagine taking this to the family level. We keep talking about managing different opinions and disagreements around the dinner table, but a lot of us navigate our disagreements nowadays with friends and strangers over social media. How has that technology changed how we argue about politics?
That's a great question. So I think the big takeaway from a study we did recently is that political interactions and political arguments are a really persistent and ubiquitous feature of the social media landscape for a lot of people today, regardless of whether they are actively seeking out those arguments or not. And a lot of folks can ignore them, and a small number really enjoy the opportunity to jump right in and take part in that political debate. But for most of the folks we talk to in our surveys, we really hear a sense of frustration over the tone of the political discussion, particularly as it pertains to social media. So just to give you a couple of data points on that, 37% of social media users tell us that they're worn out by the amount of political content they see in their feeds. 6 in 10 say that the interactions they have on social media with people they disagree with are a source of stress and frustration in their lives. And a similar share tell us that those encounters leave them feeling like they have less in common with the opposing side than they thought. So your viewpoint is certainly not unusual within the population as a whole.
Now, do people generally try to avoid these arguments on social media, Aaron?
So avoidance is typically the go-to strategy. When we ask people how they tend to respond to political discussions that they disagree with or they find disagreeable for whatever reason, the vast majority of folks, 85%, tell us that they typically just try to ignore those discussions and hope that they can go away. That said, we do find that a number of people have taken other types of actions. About 40% of social media users say that they've blocked someone or adjusted their settings so they see less from them because of their disagreements over political issues.
We've heard a lot about blocking and deleting people from their feeds and such and how it's hurting people. What are some of the trends you've identified?
So I think the first thing to note is that this is part of a broader trend that that sort of is bigger than social media. There's a lot of research showing that we're a more polarized society as pertains to politics, that levels of partisan animosity are on the rise. That said, the norms and the structure of social media can make this a particularly challenging environment for people to deal with. And one of the things that we heard in the surveys that we've done are that people's networks are comprised of a lot of different people from lots of different parts of their lives. So you've got close friends and family, you've got distant acquaintances, you maybe got some coworkers, all kind of residing in the same general space. And so when, you know, when one of those people starts making charged or potentially offensive comments about politics, it can enter people's feeds even when they didn't actively seek out that content to begin with. And that can make it really hard for people to know how to respond to those issues. That's also compounded by the fact that there's a really broad sense that people just behave in a different way on social media than they would in real life. About 85% of Americans think that people say things about politics on social media that they would never say if they were talking to someone face-to-face. So not only do you have challenging personal interactions in terms of whether you respond or not, in many cases, people feel like the people on social media are using words and using language that maybe wouldn't be the case if they were in a face-to-face discussion.
That computer courage. We have about a minute left, Aaron. I want to ask you, just is there a partisan difference here, or are essentially both sides doing this?
So as I'm sure you're well aware, it's very hard to get Democrats and Republicans to agree on anything these days. This is actually an issue where we see some bipartisanship. When we ask about whether people are worn out, whether they're frustrated, some of the pain points in their lives around this issue, we see very few differences between Democrats and Republicans. So while they're certainly responding to different issues, there's a very consistent sense that social media and politics is a pretty combustible mix and just a challenging environment for people to navigate.
Well, so I mean, all the different things, not just with people navigating them, but also law enforcement, all the forces in our lives navigating this new environment. It's got to be tough. So thank you again, Aaron, for joining us and for lending us your insight. That was Aaron Smith, Associate Director of the Internet and Technology Issues at the Pew Research Center. Aaron, we're going to be pointing a lot of people to your research. And thank you again for your time.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
All right. So again, folks, send us your stories, kcrw.com/1year later. We want to hear more from you. So again, send us your stuff. Send it. Trump supporter, Clinton supporter, no supporter. We want to hear from you. Thank you very much. And we're going to take a little break. I'm Jamil Smith, and this is 1 year later. This is the time in the show when we talk it out. We're discussing the political news of the moment, and this moment is all about, again, Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Not so much his testimony this morning before the House Judiciary Committee. No, I'm talking about the news broken last night in the New York Times and the Washington Post about Sessions, who is considering a special counsel to investigate President Trump's political rivals, including Hillary Clinton. Let's talk about this other Jeff Sessions story with Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, and Mark Joseph Stern, who covers legal affairs for Slate. Gentlemen, welcome to 1 year later.
Thanks for having us. Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Peter, your two colleagues, Michael Schmidt and Maggie Haberman, wrote yesterday that people close to the White House believe that, quoting from the report, Mr. Sessions might be able to forestall the president's firing him by appointing a special counsel to investigate the uranium deal, in which, you know, dealing with Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State. The possibility of a special counsel came up during his testimony today. What did he say?
Well, he said that he is assigned a senior federal prosecutor to take a look at a series of allegations that were sent to him by Congressman Bob Goodlatte. He's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and a Republican from Virginia. And that these career prosecutors would get back to him and let him know whether or not there was merit for a further investigation of some sort or even the possibility of an appointment of special counsel. Now, he was asked by Democrats, well, wait a second, the president's been badgering publicly for months for such an investigation. Are you being improperly influenced? And Attorney General Sessions said, no, a president can't improperly influence an investigation, and I have not been improperly influenced.
Mark, isn't he recused from all Clinton matters? I remember him mentioning that he was not going to be involved in any investigations related to the Clinton Foundation and, or, you know, I guess anything regarding her campaign.
Yes, that's right. So Sessions has said that he will recuse himself from anything relating to Secretary Clinton, and he has separately said that he would recuse himself from anything related to the 2016 campaign, which is, of course, how he has wound up recusing himself from all of the Trump-related issues. So he is not theoretically going to be at the driver's wheel of any kind of investigation into Clinton or Uranium One or any of this sort of laundry list of grievances that Republicans have tossed out. That's why this is a sort of binary choice. This is a yes or no. Is it going to be a special counsel and Sessions is going to let the special counsel do his job? Or is this going to be something that gets muffled and stifled and Sessions says, you know what, we really just do not need a special counsel to investigate the president's former political opponents?
I want your thoughts, both of you, on Sessions earlier today seeming to push back against an aggressive Republican congressman, Jim Jordan of Ohio.
What's it going to take if all that, not to mention the dossier information, what's it going to take to actually get a special counsel?
It would take a factual basis that meets the standards of the appointment of a special counsel.
And is that analysis going on right now?
Well, it's in the manual of the Department of Justice about what's required. We've only had two. The first one was the Waco, Janet Reno, Senator Danforth, who took over that investigation as special counsel, and Mr. Mueller.
Now, Congressman Jordan, we know, is one of the most hardline GOP congressmen opposing the Mueller special investigation. He's also in favor of a probe of the FBI's investigation into Secretary Clinton's email server. He wants a special counsel to investigate that. Is there any real momentum to do that, Mark? And if not right now, might Trump fire Sessions to make sure that it happens?
So this is interesting because Jeff Sessions is certainly a fire-breathing conservative in some aspects, but he also definitely believes deeply in his own perceptions of the rule of law. And I think that he studied the special counsel rules that were drafted in the late 90s under which the DOJ still operates. And I think he genuinely understands, probably far better than Representative Jordan, that there is not yet a clear reason to appoint a special counsel in this situation. It just has not risen to that level, no matter what the president may be seeing on Fox News every evening. And so I think that this exchange actually makes it more likely that Sessions will decline to appoint a special counsel. I think that we've now seen Sessions show his hand a bit by declining to kind of get into the fire-breathing excitement with Representative Jordan and say, oh, yes, this is terrible, this is awful, there's so much bad stuff, I'm really considering it. Instead, Sessions said, you know, these are the rules, this is the information we have so far, and we're evaluating it as we've been asked to. And I think if he ultimately declines to choose a special counsel, then he'll come across, for the most part, as the reasonable man to many people, certainly not to the president, who will once again get furious at him. But I think that Trump is mostly bark, no bite when it comes to his repeated threats of firing Sessions.
Yeah, that may be said. But I think, Peter, you know, there's still certainly a lot of concern for people following the Russia investigation as to whether or not the president may act impulsively suddenly when he is upset. The reporting yesterday raises question of whether Sessions is caving to the president's pressure, and it seems like he may be pushing back on that a bit. What do you expect to happen?
Well, we don't know. And that one thing we've learned, I think, in the last 10 months is making predictions is a hazardous game in this era.
Yeah, true enough.
So I'm not going to do that. But I do think that, you know, the point we were just making, I think, is actually a fair one. I mean, it's very possible that he is, reacting to pressure from the president and might appoint or have his deputy appoint a special counsel to investigate the Clintons. It's also very possible he's using this as a way to get out of that bind that the president has left him in. Remember, he's in effect said these senior federal prosecutors are going to advise him, and you could argue that he is turning the decision over to them in a way if they were to come back and say, look, we don't see a basis here for a federal special counsel investigation. He then has that as cover to make that decision. So we don't know yet, and it really could be either way.
This development comes as the revelations in the Russia investigation keep trickling out. Yesterday, of course, The Atlantic magazine reported that Donald Trump Jr. was not only communicating with Julian Assange at WikiLeaks via DM, but also essentially helping him. I mean, while he may not have been replying quite a lot, he certainly was posting links that they were asking him to post, and so was apparently the candidate himself. What do you make of that development, Mark? As charges and indictments are being considered.
Well, I think that the indictments will come down when Mueller wants us to see them. There's a very clear strategy that the special prosecutor is engaging in. He's definitely using his sources, trying to flip as many individuals as possible. So we'll see what happens with Don Jr. in terms of the actual investigation. But in terms of how the administration is perceived and how this Russia stuff is playing out in the media, it's obviously terrible for them because it's common knowledge, commonly understood, that Assange was acting as a kind of puppet for the Russian government, or at least widely believed. And so that would make Don Jr. himself a kind of puppet of Assange and by extension, the Russian government. And so here we have yet another crack in this wall that Trump and the campaign and the administration have tried to put up, where they say, look, there may be some questionable things on the side, maybe a few interns did the wrong thing, but we ourselves, we in the inner circle, we in control, we were never dealing with Russia ourselves. We were never dealing with these bad characters. We were never talking to WikiLeaks. Now we know it's not true. And so if that's not true, what were the other fabrications? What were the other misleading statements? Everyone is concerned that there's footage of every statement they've ever made. We have the audio, we have the video. How are these people going to be proved to be liars?
Peter, obviously this is a massive story that Julie Ioffe published yesterday. Do you think it might create some momentum for, say, Donald Trump Jr. to appear before Congress and testify, or potentially for Robert Mueller to pull him aside or subpoena him?
Well, certainly it's already enough that both Congress and Robert Mueller are interested in Donald Trump Jr. His meeting last year with the Russian lawyer Veselnitskaya, after being promised incriminating information about Hillary Clinton, is part of this investigation in a big way. So this will certainly add further fuel to that fire. I think one thing is we really learn from these emails, maybe less about Donald Trump Jr. than we do about WikiLeaks. Interestingly enough, WikiLeaks itself recognizes in the emails it sends him that it is perceived as being pro-Russia and being pro-Trump. And in fact, there is various points trying to argue or make suggestions to Donald Trump Jr. to leak to them some damaging information that they think is going to come out about future President Trump anyway, as a way of inoculating themselves against this perception. In effect, they were acting, though, as an arm of the Trump campaign. That's very clear from these emails. Whether or not they were under direction or not is a different question, but they certainly saw themselves as promoting the Trump candidacy.
Now, Mark, I want to ask you just to conclude here. GOP members of Congress are still complaining about Mueller and his investigation. This investigation of Russia, but they're also complaining about how the investigation into Clinton's email server was handled. Is all this just to cater to the base, or is there actual meat behind this?
I think a great deal of it is certainly to cater to the base. All of what you just mentioned and this call for a special counsel to investigate the Clintons, right? This would almost sort of contrast or balance out a Mueller special counsel. And I think that there's a widespread appetite among Republicans to get back at Comey for, how he theoretically, hypothetically, allegedly betrayed Trump, right? There's still a lot of anger at the base. Among the base at Comey. But some of it, I think, is genuine. I think a lot of Republicans really believe that this is a witch hunt. I think that they think the previous FBI director was out to get him. I think they don't like Mueller. There's all this talk that, Mueller hired people who donated to the Clintons. It's mostly nonsense, but of course it's a line that they can grab onto. And I think that whether or not they believed it at first, they've talked themselves into a kind of tizzy. So it's a mistake to perceive all of this as posturing or empty rhetoric. There is a real hunger among at least a powerful minority of Republicans on the Hill to get back at Comey and to stop Mueller, or at least end the investigation as quickly as possible, even if it would be premature.
And quickly, Peter, we see that the president's approval numbers are down in the mid-30s still. Given those numbers, is there really any political momentum? Does he have any actually leverage to make something happen?
Well, usually a president with those kind of numbers or anywhere near those kind of numbers is considered to be pretty weak in Washington. Other politicians pay attention and they respond accordingly. This president has managed to play a weak hand pretty strongly. He has, even though he does have a low approval rating, still commands and dominates the political environment in Washington in a way that, while he's lost some members of his party, the vast majority in Congress are still sticking with him and maybe maybe a little intimidated by him. So, you know,
we'll
I think that that's still to be seen, yeah.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, Peter Baker and Mark Joseph Stern. And so this that's it for today on One Year Later. I get to choose the music we go out on since and since we just talked a lot about Jeff Sessions and this administration, I'm going to have the Isley Brothers take us out with Fight the Power.
PRI, Public Radio International.